Well, whether it's a perfectly prepared burger or a gorgeous leg of lamb, a great meat dish is a combination of the right cut and the best preparation. And even if we cook with meat regularly, we may not know the ins and outs of how to maximize that flavor and the texture. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Bruce Adels is a self-described meat guru, and he currently has, and I believe him because I've taken a look at his book, he currently has a national cooking show called Good Cooking with Bruce Adels on the LiveWell Network, excuse me. He also writes for Bon Appetit magazine, for Real Food magazine, and Fine Cooking, and he's a contributing editor for Eating Well magazine. His latest book, it's a dandy, The Great Meat Cookbook, Everything You Need to Know to Buy and Cook Today's Meat. And he is our guest today, and certainly as we visit with him by phone, I hope you will join in. Do you feel confident choosing the right cuts of meat? Are you game for trying different types of meat, or do you stick with the pork and beef pretty much? Do you have a favorite meat recipe you'd like to talk about, or do you have a question about preparing a particular meat? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And before I forget it, I do want to mention that on my Facebook page, we have several recipes, a half a dozen, I believe, from Bruce's book, The Great Meat Cookbook, and there's some dandies, and you're going to want to, if nothing else, go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Take a look at those recipes. You're going to be very pleasantly surprised at the wonderful the recipes that are there. And Bruce, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's my pleasure. I'll have to go to your website to see the recipes you chose.
Well, we've got some dandies up there, and the first one is spicy and smoky Mexican goat kebabs.
Wow. So can you get goat? Well, you should be able to get goat in Wisconsin because you've got such a big cheese business going on, and often the male goats, which aren't too valuable for the cheese world, make very good meat goats. So and they end up in kebabs and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know, I taught at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad for a year, and there, goat was the primary meat, and I really like goat a lot.
That's true, and I do recommend there's a, because you really know this recipe, there's a pretty authentic goat curry that like you might find in any of the Caribbean islands. This particular one comes from Trinidad from a chef who is from Sri Lanka originally, but as you know, they love their goat in that part of the world.
Oh, absolutely, and it's a wonderful meat. I really enjoy it. How did you get so involved with meat? Been doing it for a long time. I can see
this
that.
Is true. This is true. Well, I really want to ask backwards, I must say. I have a PhD in endocrinology, and so I was actually doing breast cancer research, which brought me to London. And yeah, things don't ever go as they're planned. Although, while getting my PhD, which I got from UC Santa Cruz, which is one of the California University campuses, I had the pleasure of running a little restaurant right on the campus for half a year. And I really loved that experience. It was just kind of a side thing. And eventually my professor asked me if I was ever going to get back in the lab and actually graduate. So this is all true. So that was my little experience. And, you know, otherwise, you know, I spent the 5 years working on the PhD, which, as my life turned out, wasn't that relevant to the rest of my life. But eventually, I took my amateur love for cooking to become a professional and started as a chef. And I just happened to be working in a charcuterie. So meat preparations was, you know, a big part of what we did, although the place was called Poulet. It's still there in Berkeley. And, you know, we were supposed to be concentrating on chicken, but I did sneak in the odd pork, the sausage, the pate every so often. But, yeah, cooked a lot of chicken dishes, which is the reason I've never written any books on chicken. I am fed up with it.
Oh, man, yeah, you probably had your fill of it. You know, I should mention that my PhD is in mass communication, but my bachelor's degree is in animal science.
Whoa.
And so I judged meat and as part of collegiate judging carcasses, right, and cuts and so forth. And sort of that's come in handy at the grocery store.
Absolutely. Well, I had to pick that stuff up by basically reading and talking to a lot of people. And I'm not trained as a butcher. I'm actually trained as a biologist, but then I worked as a chef for about 4 or 5 years and then started a sausage company, which was sort of a growth. Also came from my experience in England because I hated the British banger. And so started making my own while I was there just for fun.
Oh, man. Have some meats over time, I'm wondering how meat has changed over the past few decades. Any difference as far as you can see?
Oh, absolutely. Well, huge change took place in the mid-80s. Number one, the USDA, which oversees the production of meat and plants and all that, actually changed their grading system, which when it comes to beef, you know, meat is graded on marbling, which is that little specks of fat. So they basically lowered the grading system so that the leaner meat would be more common in the marketplace. And at the same time, the pork industry decided that it had a really bad image, that pork was considered unhealthy and fatty, and basically put their pigs on a diet. So that pork became probably one of the leanest meats you could buy. But that caused a lot of problems for the people that were trying to cook this stuff because old recipes didn't work so well because the internal fat is what provides moisture. So when you cook something well done, it can become very dry and hard. Mm-hmm. But it took a few years for the cookbook and food writing world to sort of catch up with this. And by the time I wrote my last meat book, which was about the mid-90s, you know, people were having a lot of problems. And so we... and this is me and my co-author, Dennis Kelly. We started reassessing how you should cook this meat and really relying on using a thermometer, which is really is what's going to determine the doneness, the internal temperature of the meat. And so we started really stressing that. Meanwhile, I think since I wrote that one, so we're talking about mid-90s, a lot of things came into the sort of the national psyche when it came to meat. Number one, we had problems with some serious outbreaks of E. coli. And people just, probably due to Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma and other authors, we became aware of how animals are raised, the feedlots, and the issue of antibiotics and hormones. And big grocery stores around the country started selling more politically correct meat. I'm talking places like Whole Foods, for instance, which is a large retailer. So our psyche changed, and I felt I really needed to readdress all these issues. Plus, because of the internet and the growth of farmers markets, the diversity, our choices had grown. I mean, in the mid '90s, if you wanted to have goat, unless you happen to know a goat producer down the road, you probably weren't going to get any goat. If you want a grass-fed beef, again, unless you knew a farmer willing to do that for you, you weren't going to find that. But now you can, and anybody can find it anywhere in the country because they can get it on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of us probably shop in farmers markets, and that often comes to market. The idea of going back to the heirloom breeds of pork, the fattier pork that had a lot more flavor, that wasn't really possible in the mid-90s as well. But now, you go to a farmer's market and you can find Duroc, Red Wattle, Mulefoot, all these wonderful breeds. So, again, I wanted to address, how do you cook all this stuff? And then there's bison, which was really just very infantile in the 90s. And now pretty much most grocery stores, I would say, at least carry a bison burger.
Yeah.
And the better stores carry even more choices.
Yeah, so there's a lot of choice out there, and boy, you cover it in your book.
Well, I certainly tried. I mean, it's a big book, but if you can believe it, we had to get rid of 200 pages.
Oh, boy.
Well, here's the deal. Strategically, you never, ever want to title a book the complete anything, and that's what I titled the one in the 90s. So I had to do something more than complete. Of course, we couldn't call it more than complete, so we opted for a more vague term, the Great Meat Cookbook. But that's essentially what I had to do. I had to really go the next step and add all the possible cuts that one could buy and, you know, all the different choices.
Oh, and there are lots of them out there. Our guest today, Bruce Adels, is author of The Great Meat Cookbook. Great to have him along. Join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jerry in DeForest now. Jerry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, it's wonderful to be out here. It's a great topic. Bruce, I cannot wait to buy your book.
Well, thank you.
I'm a truck driver. I'm actually driving through Wisconsin now, but I live in Liberty, North Carolina. I get home about every 3 weeks or so, and my son, youngest son, and I always get together and grill out. We don't care what the weather is, we grill out. And my question is, what is, in your opinion, what is the best type of steak to buy, and how would you prepare it so that, you know, it doesn't become too tough? We both like our meat medium well done, but if there's a better way to prepare it, I'm pretty sure that I can talk my son into doing that way. But we do love steak, and that's usually what we cook out. And so just in your opinion, what is the best cut of meat to buy, and how should I prepare that?
Just one quick question for you, Jerry. Do you have a gas grill, or do you use a charcoal grill?
I have both.
Yeah, both. Okay.
Yeah, normally in wintertime, you know, we have a really short winter in North Carolina, but when it is real cold, we will use the gas grill. I myself prefer to use charcoal.
Bruce, what do you think?
Well, I think the key thing that Jerry just mentioned was the medium well. A lot of those leaner cuts of steak, when you cook them medium well, are going to dry out because they don't have enough internal marbling to be able to stay juicy. So I'm going to go with my favorite steaks are the rib steaks, and I would look for, since Jerry likes them medium well, I would go for the best quality you could afford, which would at least be choice, if not the higher end of choice. And then the nice thing about steak, and a good way to keep it so it's not boring, since you like to cook it a lot, Jerry, is look to some of the dry rubs and marinades that help to kind of add another flavor profile to the steak. I particularly like this one in my book that actually uses a little bit of ground coffee and a tiny bit of chocolate, cocoa powder. It gives a steak a wonderful crust. And I like the method where you hit the steak with some really high heat to get a nice sear on it, and because I like to cook really thick steaks. And then I like to move it to the side and then cook it slowly till it reaches the proper level of doneness. That way you don't lose as much moisture. And I like to, you know, do a 2 or 3 inch steak and then, you know, cut it up and share it among the family members.
And you like a meat thermometer. You mentioned that a little bit earlier, but I think that's
so
important.
To be sure, if you like it medium well, I mean, you want to pull it off the fire probably around an internal temperature of 140 to 145, and then it's very important to let it rest so it continues to cook and those juices get reabsorbed. And it'll end up around 150 or 155, which is the medium well range.
But very well. Very good.
All right. Thanks a lot for – and this resting business, I always think it's – I mean, I've seen people take their steaks off the grill and start cutting them up, or their turkey or whatever it is, and that is just, you just don't want to do that.
No, well, the proof is in all the liquid that comes out of the meat.
Yeah.
You can prove it to yourself. Do two steaks, you know, pretty much the same, you know, side by side, cut one up immediately and leave the other one for 10 minutes or so, and then just see how much liquid there is on the bottom of the plate.
Yeah, and it's going to be a lot. Bruce Adels, our guest today, author of The Great Meat Cookbook. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments. Do you feel confident choosing the right cut of meat? What do you like to cook? What questions might you have? Maybe you've got a favorite meat recipe you'd like to tell us about. The number, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.com. www.larrymehler.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mehler Show. You should go there anyway because we've got a half a dozen or so of Bruce's recipes up on the page. Larry Mehler here, our on-air producer, Rob Ferret, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in today as we talk about cooking meat today with Bruce Adels, who is a meat guru, currently has a national cooking show called Good Cooking with Bruce Adels on the Live Well Network. Great to have him along. His latest book, Great Meat Cookbook, Everything You Need to Know to Buy and Cook Today's Meat. And it's a fascinating book. I mean, I'm really enjoying going through it. It's a huge book. To be honest with you, I have not read all the recipes in this book, nor have I read all of the information. And there's a lot of information, not only the recipes, but cooking tips and so forth that are very important as well. So join in with your own questions. Again, 1-800-642-1234. And Bob in Wauwatosa, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Great guest as usual, Larry.
Thank you.
I don't know how you pick them, but you do a great job. I'd like to ask your guest the question that has puzzled my wife and I for years, if not decades, and if he can answer this satisfactorily, we might just run out and buy his book. The question is, when you let meat rest, we have always equated resting with getting cold. So how do you do this?
All right.
The critical question is how long. I mean, if you let something rest for an hour, it's probably... So there are two things that are going on when you set a piece of meat to rest. Number one, the heat is, which is hottest at the surface, is migrating towards the interior to complete the cooking. Then, of course, it's also migrating outward into the general environment and will eventually cool down. You can impede that a little bit by loosely covering the piece of meat with foil, which is a lot of recipes tell you to do. But the key issue is the timing. So for a huge prime rib, let's say an 8 or 10-pound prime rib, the truth is that thing can sit there for 45 minutes. It's still going to be very, 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 very hot when you go to cut it. But, you know, 1-inch thick steak, you know, after 5 or 7 minutes, it's going to start to lose temperature.
Yeah.
So it's all a matter of timing. And I would say that every recipe that I write, I actually give you a recommended time range.
Is there some rule of thumb equating minutes of resting with pounds of the cut of beef or thickness? Or is that kind of,
I hate rule of thumbs because there's always exceptions. That's why I prefer to just give you the actual time in each recipe.
Okay.
Plus, I understand it's pretty cold there in Wisconsin. If you let it rest outdoors, the ambient temperature obviously is going to affect things as well.
Sure.
So most recipes are assuming that you're doing this in a sort of standard kitchen, let's say that's 65 to 70 degrees temperature. That obviously is going to affect that. If you did it outdoors today in where you are, it'd probably go cold in 1 minute.
It's about -1 here today in Madison. So
-1, there you go. So you let it rest for 20 minutes and it'd be frozen. it's all in the timing. So I often use what I call a continuous read thermometer. So that gives you the internal temperature, and you have a little printout and a little digital readout and
sure.
a table. So you can actually watch it, and you can see what the internal temperature is, and you'll see it rise for that first 10-minute period. Then when it starts to drop, you're done, and you can go ahead and serve it.
But you advise resting in a warm oven?
Absolutely not.
No,
because
room
that's really going to continue to cook something. No, you usually let it rest on the counter or on the platter, and loosely covered with foil, like I say, will slow the process down a little
okay.
bit.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks,
sure.
Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have Craig in Hamburg next. Hi, Craig. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I raise grass-fed beef and sell it at the local farmer's market, and a few weeks ago I got an email from a lady who bought a chuck roast from me, and she said after they cooked it, the inside of it was gelatinous and gooey, and they couldn't eat, you know, they couldn't eat it, and wondered if I had any idea what that was. And I didn't really know. I also have a friend who does the same thing. I forwarded the email to him. He's in the same area here, and he actually got the same email from this lady also with the same complaint. So I'm wondering if you have any idea what that is.
So you're saying your friend, these are totally different source of meat? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, two different farms on two different sides of town.
I would say that somebody's idea of gelatinous and gooey might be what my idea of beautifully tender and juicy. What happens with those tougher cuts as you cook them long and slow, hopefully in a moist environment, all that collagen, you know, that makes it tough is gelatinized and becomes soft and silky, which gives it, I think, a very, very nice texture and results in a nice tender pot roast. Maybe that's this woman's doesn't, I don't know what to say. It's the first time I've heard those terms, when, especially in reference to Chuck.
Yeah.
I'm going to say. I couldn't tell you how to respond to her, but tell her to try leaner cuts and not make pot roast. I don't know.
I've never heard that either. No idea.
It's hard to know how to respond. I'll put a plug in. I think that the flank steak and the skirt steak is the best steak. That's the one I save off of my animal for our own family.
The flank steak?
Flank and skirt, yeah.
Oh, and skirt.
I totally agree with you, though. They have great beefy flavor. I wasn't recommending it to this guy that liked his stuff medium well, though, because especially the flank would really dry out, I think, if you cook it to medium well. I would never recommend cooking a flank steak to medium well unless it was really heavily marbled. But
there should be a law against cooking things medium well anyway.
Right, but I didn't want to say that. I mean, you know, that's a guy's preference. So, but I totally agree with you. But flank steak is very versatile, too. I mean, besides grilling it, you can use it and stuff it, and it makes a great little roast.
Yep, absolutely. Craig, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call. 1-800-642-1234, the number for you to call in to join us with a question or comment for our guest today, Bruce Adell's author of The Great Meat Cookbook. And Dale in Mequon. It's your turn next. Hi, Dale.
Hi. Good morning, Bruce and Larry. Thanks for a great show in the dead of winter like this. There's nothing that warms my heart as burning animal flesh on a grill in the frigid cold. My question for Bruce is if he is familiar with the America's Test Kitchen dry rub for steaks, which is simply salt and cornstarch, and it's supposed to create a nice crusty exterior and a juicy interior.
I'm not familiar with that specific rub. I'm certainly familiar with the Cook's Illustrated people and have the America's Test Kitchen and all that kind of stuff. The only time I've run into cornstarch used on the exterior is in Chinese cooking. Often, if you look at recipes for beef stir fries, they'll have you toss the strips of meat in a mixture of soy sauce and cornstarch. That gives it kind of a little bit of a skin. I'm not familiar with it in the way you're talking about. Have you tried it?
Yes, I have. It does produce a nice crusty exterior and a juicy interior. The only downside is it's a little putsy because the salt cornstarch mixture tends to draw moisture out of the steak a little bit, and you have to keep patting the steak to keep the moisture off of it. It will almost start to bleed, and you don't want the moisture on the exterior because it then steams the steak on the grill. You want the steak to char, and then you want a juicy interior. So it seems to work pretty well, but it's a little labor-intensive.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what it's bringing to the table. I mean, I really like that rub I mentioned earlier that uses a little bit of ground coffee and chocolate because it produces an amazing exterior. I mean, it's not like you're hit over the head with the chocolate or the coffee, but the net result on a steak is it just has this great – it really complements those charred flavors. The little bit of that bitterness in both the chocolate and the coffee, I suppose, really blend well with that. It's a great rub, and I've never had issues –
with the steaks not being juicy if they're properly cooked and getting a nice exterior. So I don't see the need for it, but, you know, this is America's Test Kitchen. They got to constantly come up with new things, you know, or they're going to lose their audience. So
now,
it sounds like it's more trouble than it's worth to me.
Thanks, Dale.
Bye now.
Appreciate it very much. You know, as long as salt came up in that conversation in your book, you talk about salting meat and the fact that there's always the comment, well, if we put salt on meat before we cook it, it's going to draw all the juices out. But that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No. I mean, I don't believe that at all. I mean, it's very, very true that if you salt a piece of meat and leave it for a day or two, through the process of osmosis, it's going to draw moisture out. But we're talking much shorter periods of time. And I think the beauty about salting meat before you cook it is that the salt begins to penetrate beyond just the surface into, you know, a little bit into the meat, which helps to really add a beautiful flavor profile. So the net result is that that nice seared exterior has a rounded flavor as opposed to just being hit over the head with notes of salt if you season it afterwards.
After the case, yes. Yeah. Christine in Harvard, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
My question is, how would you recommend cooking a prime rib? You hear so many different techniques as far as, you know, doing it slow or turning off the oven. We like our meat bloody or medium rare, you know, but just what is a good tip on cooking a prime rib?
Well, the best tip by far is to use a thermometer to judge doneness. That turning off the oven method, I'm no fan of that. There's too much chance for variability. Ovens, as you know, vary a lot in terms of their how well insulated, how well they hold their heat, the accuracy of their temperature. There's no better way to cook a prime rib than to know when it's done by measuring the internal temperature. And as you know, a prime rib is a very expensive cut of meat. So you're going to invest a couple $100. And for $15 more, you can buy a nice, what I call continuous read thermometer that you stick into the roast. And it has a little cable that gives you a readout. You can preset an alarm. I'm a fan of the British method, which means you start it at high temperature, 450 for 15 minutes to get a nice crust on the outside. And then you reduce it down to a moderate temperature of 325 or 350.
Okay.
And then you pull it out. Let's say you said you liked it medium rare?
Correct.
Okay, so you pull it out at about an internal temperature of about 115 to 120.
Okay.
And then you let it rest for about a half hour to 40 minutes, loosely tinted, and it will come up about another 10 or 15 degrees to that range of around, medium rare is like 130, 135. Okay.
So well, I definitely am going to get your book, and I'm going to try that this weekend. We shop local at a butcher, so I'm going to do everything you said, your book, and let you know the results.
There's a lot of great prime rib recipes, and in fact, the cover recipe is a stuffed prime rib that's pretty awesome. So,
it looks great.
I'm going to do that this weekend. I'm going to get your book, so thank you so much. Have a great day.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. One of the things I enjoy about a good cookbook, oftentimes we'll have some good photography or great photography. And you have some wonderful food photography in your book, Bruce. That picture of the bison cottage pie,
yeah.
For example, I just want to eat the page.
I was very fortunate. This was a husband and wife team out of Santa Barbara. Husband is an Italian guy, and his wife did all the food styling. So that means she actually cooked the recipes, and then he photographed them. He also came up to my house because I'm about 400 miles away from or 300 miles from Santa Barbara, and he took the pictures of me and hung out in my kitchen. It was kind of a fun day. I made sure we had plenty of pasta. We had pasta and homemade sausages. And a nice bottle of Italian wine. So it was a really good day.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Well, again, I like cottage pie anyway. And then to see that photo of that bison cottage pie, oh, man, I've got it. That's one I'm going to be trying for sure. Greg in Door County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I keep hearing, cook with a thermometer and use a thermometer. Well, how do you figure out what's a good thermometer and what's the difference between a cheap thermometer that's not good and a good one that does what you need it to do.
Yeah, and Bruce, you address that in your book.
I love this question. Well, I'm absolutely sold on the thermal pin, as are those the people from America's Test Kitchen and actually all of the national cookie magazines that have compared various thermometers. The thermal pin is made by a company called ThermalWorks, and they're out of Utah. And it's what makes a really good thermometer is that it doesn't break when you drop it. And most instant read digital thermometers, when you drop them, they break, unfortunately. Now, the ones that are dial type that operate on a spring, they're fine, but they're not very accurate, and they're not very sensitive compared to a digital one. What's wonderful about the thermal pin is it uses a more exact technology. It's actually a thermal couple as opposed to a thermistor, which is so it's much more accurate and much faster. So you can get a reading within 2 seconds. It has no buttons to push. You just simply it looks like kind of like a jackknife. You just open up the probe, and that turns it on. And then it automatically shuts itself off after 10 minutes, so you don't have to worry about burning out the batteries. You can drop this thing. You can kick it. It can get wet. You can't obviously soak it, but it can get splashed. And let's face it, kitchens, water is always around. Pretty much all of us professional types prefer that. The issue is it's more expensive, whereas an instant read thermometer will cost you around $20 to $30 for a digital one. This one is in the $80 range. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's going to last the rest of your life. It has 1,500 hours of battery life in it, which is a long time. And then I also recommend getting one of these cable-type thermometers, which are great for roasting. And that's the kind you can leave in, and it'll give you a readout, and you can preset it. And they usually come with a timer, which is kind of nice to have, too. So what I usually do is I preset, if I'm roasting something, I'll preset it about 10 degrees lower than I really want it to be. And then when that alarm goes off, I then test in several spots with my thermal pin instant read thermometer, which I trust more than I do the other one. And if it comes up to the right temperature, I pull it out and let it rest.
Great.
But it's a great investment. If you do purchase one of my books, I have a little deal going with the ThermalWorks people. They'll give you a little discount if you go to their website.
All right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Talking today with Bruce Adels about his book, The Great Meat Cookbook, obviously talking about cooking with all kinds of meat. You may have a question about cooking a particular cut. You may have want to share something relating to cooking meats yourself, maybe some sort of favorite meat recipe. Are you game for trying products, meats other than pork and beef? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. And let's go to the, I haven't gone to the emails section here yet. Tom emailed and said, I wanted to add that searing the back strips of venison with a good rub and moving them to the side of a charcoal grill has resulted in some steaks that my non-hunting family have proclaimed are better than the steaks they get out of a restaurant or the deli. What about tips for preparing wild game? Turkey season is coming up.
Right. Well, I have cooked venison and wild boar. We have these animals running around a lot where I live here in Northern California. They're very, very lean meats, and I really like the method that your writer just mentioned. That's a great thing to do, is to just sear the outside and let the meat cook slowly off to the side. You got to be really careful with venison because it essentially has zero marbling.
Yeah.
And you cannot eat that meat medium well.
No.
It's really dry and hard and get that livery texture that most of us don't care for. I particularly like the gnarly cuts, both from venison and also bison. Because, well, like we talked about earlier, the gnarly cuts are loaded with collagen, which when you cook something long and slow with moist heat, turns into gelatin, and you get that wonderful soft gelatinous texture, and very, very tender. And even though it doesn't have marbling, it has the mouthfeel and that it would have if it did have ample fat. So don't ignore those shoulder cuts and leg cuts from the wild game. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with venison sausage. I think most people's problem with venison sausage is they don't get enough pork and pork fat into it. You do want to head for at least 20% fat in your final mixture. Otherwise, it really isn't going to be very good.
Yeah, very, very good points. Jeff in La Crosse, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Very interesting program. I do a lot of grilling and that, charcoaling, and but I had a question for your guest regarding tenderizing meat cuts. You know, you recommend buying the choice, but getting to like the select cuts and that, so it's not not the best marbling and that. But I've got a handheld tenderizer type of tool, and it's got quite a few of those small little blades in it.
Right. I talk about that. That's called a Jacquard.
Yeah.
A lot of steak restaurants will routinely use that, even though they're buying, you know, the top end of choice, because some of the cuts that people, some of the favorite cuts, like the New York strip, really has some issues, some areas of the New York strip that can be chewy and people complain. So that's a very, very good tool. So essentially what that is a an instrument that has a number of very sharp, thin blades that pierce through the meat to help to cut the fibers and to tenderize that. And once you do that, you can also then add a marinade, which marinades don't really tenderize, but they certainly add a lot of nice flavor. And now that you've created the channels in the meat where you've pierced it, some of that marinade will penetrate down through there.
Right.
So I think that's also a nice thing. But that's a great thing to have, that Jacquard. I do not recommend commercial tenderizers, you know, based on papaya enzymes, because that gives you a kind of a gummy exterior, and I don't think it's very effective on the interior. And when it does thoroughly tenderize, you get this kind of soft, mushy texture. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
I hate that texture, so I don't recommend those at all. But that Jacquard that you've purchased is a very, very good instrument.
I've had real good luck with it.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Bruce Adell is author of The Great Meat Cookbook. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At noon today, we'll be broadcasting live from the Martin Luther King Jr. event at the Wisconsin State Capitol. But right now, we're visiting with Bruce Adell, who is a meat guru for sure. Has done a lot of television shows. He's got a national cooking show called Good Cooking with Bruce Adell on the Live Well Network. He's written for many magazines and has some great books out there, including his latest is called The Great Meat Cookbook, Everything You Need to Know to Buy and Cook Today's Meats. And Bruce Adell, and his last name, by the way, I should spell that for you. It's Aide. It's like Aide, AIDELLS. Bruce Adels. And tell you what, let's go back to the phones. David in Amory, has been waiting a bit. Let's go to him. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I lived in Europe for 19 years, and I grew to love rabbit. And it's so hard to find. I can find it once in a while, and Does Bruce have ideas of different ways of cooking rabbit? My mother-in-law always used to stick it in a Rermetopf and stuff it, and that was wonderful, but there's got to be other ways. I know there's rabbit ragu and things like that.
Yeah.
I do, and I share with you a love for rabbit. In fact, we have a rabbit in our fridge right now that was roasted on the spit. That's a good way for a really young rabbit, so you brush it with a little olive oil and put some mixture of fresh herbs. But you got to be really careful. Rabbit, obviously, is very lean, so when you roast it on a spit, you've got to get it so it's still slightly pink at the bones. But my I particularly like to deal with the older rabbits that are fuller in flavor and do the classic ragouts like you're talking about in fricassees. I think one of my favorite is a German recipe called Hasenpfeffer.
Yep.
Are you familiar with that? It uses mustard. For some reason, mustard and rabbit just really blend beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And when I say mustard, I mean the classic French Dijon mustard.
Yeah. Yep.
My mother-in-law used to make it once in a while. Oh, my God, it was my favorite dish.
Yeah. I have published some recipes for rabbit. I don't have any rabbit recipes in the Great Meat Cookbook simply because I handed away too big a book with just the red meats. But I'll tell you some good sources. I would send you, there's a couple of really good internet sources. I would always start with Epicurious, which is the internet site for gourmet and Bon Appetit magazines. Those are really good recipes. They've been fully tested. They're written by people that, you know, do this for a living.
Right.
That's a really good place. There are some good game books out there. I know years ago a fellow named John Ash wrote an excellent game cookbook. I know there's a couple others. John Ash is a very conscientious cook, somebody who I really trust and a very, very good cook. That would be good, too. But I always start with Epicurious just because I know those recipes have really been well-tested and have all been published in, you know, respected magazines.
That's Epiland and Curious, like normal Curious written together.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot for calling. As a matter of fact, my wife, who went to chef school herself, and now works in the College of Engineering at the University of Wisconsin.
There you go.
But she started there. She's got Epicurious is often. I see her go there pretty often, actually.
And where did she go to chef school?
In Madison.
Aha!
Through the Madison Area Technical College, and she chefed. She was a pastry chef, and that's how she put herself through the regular University of Wisconsin as worked her way through as a pastry chef. So,
great.
That's how she had to go to work at four in the morning, but then she was done early enough to take those university classes. Warren in Beloit, it is your turn. Hi, Warren.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
All right. My dilemma is my wife and I have been married for 12 years, and she likes well-done meat, and it hurts my feelings every time I cook it. Is there a certain steak that I can cook well-done and not feel bad about it? What do you suggest?
Are you a wealthy fellow?
No, sir.
Well, I mean, the fattier, the better marbled the meat, the better it'll turn out well done. And that means buying prime meat, which tends to be pretty expensive. But again, I would have to send you to the most marbled areas. Actually, there's a wonderful steak that's relatively new for people called the Flatiron, which actually comes off of the shoulder blade.
Yeah.
That's a heavily marbled steak, even when it's not prime, and that might be a good choice. Otherwise...
And you're seeing that. We're seeing that in grocery stores here.
Yeah, certainly it's been on restaurant menus for several years now. That would be a really good choice for you. Another good choice, of course, is anything to do with the rib area, the ribeye, but you want to make sure it's pretty heavily marbled. If you like your meat well done, I would gear you more towards a braised steak where you're starting with a tougher cut like a chuck and cooking it long and slow in a sauce that helps the flavor of the steak. And that way it's both delicious and has that added flavor. But it's not like, you know, you can't grill that kind of thing. It's you know,
it's kind of like a roast.
Hot roasted. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just happen to like
yep.
hot roast better than I do grilling steak to that, you know, that level of doneness.
Yeah, absolutely.
But definitely try the Flatiron. It's a very tasty cut.
Thanks again, Warren. Patrick in Eastman, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. How to cook chicken gizzards so that they're tender, and how to do a good steak tartare.
Well, those are too extreme.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Well, years ago, I worked as a chef in a restaurant called Poulet. And needless to say, we accumulated lots of gizzards. And I used to grind them up and use it as part of my bolognese or, you know, my red sauce, spaghetti sauce.
Yeah.
Very, very nice thing to do. But in general, you got to cook gizzards a fair amount of time till they're tender. And I usually do them in some kind of in a broth, kind of a braise. I particularly like to do them in, you know, like a tomato sauce kind of base, but they could also be good with just your classic wine sauce or, I mean, I happen to like food from the Middle East and India, so I would put them into things like curries and stuff like that. But you do have to cook them, you know, they need moist heat, obviously, and you got to cook them long and slow. They're going to take, 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have Don in Tomahawk. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hey, you got a great show and a great guest on there. I've got a question for your guest and then something about sauerbraten that's been in my Swiss German family for years. Wild turkey breast, you know, that's about the only part of the wild turkey that you can actually salvage after you get one. And they're large. They're like almost 3 pounds. What's a good way to prepare those?
You know, we have lots. I don't know what your wild turkeys are in Wisconsin. We got a lot of them running around here. We even have. I live in two places. I live in the city of Berkeley, and the wild turkeys have migrated down into town, and they're messy, and they like to roost on car tops. I don't know if you have that problem where you are.
Well, we don't have that problem, but we've got some big turkey. You know, wild turkeys.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you want to take the time and effort, I mean, there's nothing better than smoking them, but that would involve first a light brining and then, you know, a very slow smoke, so because obviously they dry out really easily. The few times I've cooked wild turkey, the truth is I love to use them in gumbo. I think a wild turkey gumbo is one of the best gumbos I've ever had. And there, you know, you're cooking it fairly long and slow, and you know, it's a soup, basically. It's a good recipe. Or just a standard, you tie it and like into a nice little bundle and then just pot roast it. I think if you're going to roast it as is, I would roll it, coat it in strips of bacon, and make sure that I roasted it till it was just done to probably an internal temperature of about 150 degrees maximum. Otherwise, it's really going to dry out.
You know, and I did. I had a shot one this last year, and it was about 23 pounder or so on the hoof. And I grilled the breast, and I just put some. I had an oil and some garlic, and just made sure that I got it off the grill at the right temperature. You know, so it wasn't overcooked, and it was really good.
That would be good. That's another good way. You could also cut medallions and grill them.
Yeah.
So they're about half inch thick, and then just put a nice, you know, brush it with a little oil and a nice little rub on it. But the key thing is just not to overcook it, just to go on a little bit on the underside.
Okay, well, thank you very much. One suggestion, and you had a guest on there that was talking about tenderizing meat, et cetera.
Yeah.
Come from an old Swiss-German family, and we've made sauerbraten ever since, man, I could walk. And our secret versus what you buy in a restaurant that has the ginger snap sauce and everything, we marinate a choice chuck roast when we find them on sale, a good-sized one, for at least 3 to 4 days in a vinegar marinade. And then what my wife does is she cuts the chuck up into chunks, and she'll sear it in a Presto pressure cooker, and then she'll pressure cook that. And that meat, you know, along with the gravy that goes with it, the mashed potatoes, is just unbelievable.
Well, yeah, that moist heat, and there, you know, it's fairly high temperature moist heat, will really give you a nice, you know, really tenderized, tough pieces of meat. That's a great way to do it.
I tell you what, this has been wonderful, Bruce. Thank you so much. I hope we have a chance to do this again.
Well, I'm always available, Larry. It was a pleasure talking to you,
your guest asked some really good questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Bruce Adels is author of The Great Meat Cookbook. I really enjoyed this book, and I really enjoyed talking with him today. And we'll try to get him back and do this again, because it was a really great show, I thought. Well, stay tuned. We're going to be broadcasting live from the Martin Luther King Jr. event at the Wisconsin State Capitol. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network.